I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times.
This is the first time in American history that we've nominated a woman who's unashamedly pro-life and embraces her faith without apology, and she's going to the court. Seat at the table is waiting on you, and it will be a great signal to all young women who want to, who share your view of the world, that there's a seat at the table for them.
That was Senate Judiciary Chairman Republican Lindsey Graham earlier this week telling Judge Amy Coney Barrett that it looks like she will be the next justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. A vote is set for next Thursday. The death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg fast-tracked this nomination, with President Trump declaring that he was putting pro-life justices on the court to overturn Roe v. Wade and that he wants the Affordable Care Act overturned, a case that will be argued before the court in November. Trump has also said that he was counting on the court to review mail-in ballots if there's a dispute over the results of the November election. Well, today on Radio Times, what did we learn this week about Judge Amy Coney Barrett? What didn't we learn? And assuming she gets the job, how will her presence change the highest court and the rule of law? Joining us by Skype is Michael Moreland. He's a professor of law, director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy at Villanova University. Michael Moreland, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Also with us is Laura Little, and she's the James G. Schmidt Professor of Law at Temple University, author of a recent book on humor and the law called Guilty Pleasures, and she's working on a forthcoming book on the First Amendment. Laura Little, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
And to our listeners, we want to hear from you. If you listened or watched and it was carried on our airwaves here at WHYY, what do you make of Judge Amy Coney Barrett? Does she have the qualifications to sit on the highest court? Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Laura, let me begin with you. The American Bar Association says she is well qualified. That's their highest rating. Is Amy Coney Barrett, is she qualified to sit on the highest court?
Absolutely. She's, as I think one conservative observer said, she is the best apple in the barrel, if the barrel is how you define, you know, what they wanted on the court. She is extremely well-schooled, extremely intelligent, and has worked really hard.
How about for you, Michael Moreland? How do you see her?
I agree with that. I think she clearly has the intelligence and the character and the disposition that she's shown as a judge on the Seventh Circuit the last several years. So I think she's a very strong nominee.
Well, let me put a process question to both of you. And Laura, I'll go back to you. In a sense, and maybe more in hindsight, what was the point of these hearings in that we largely know the outcome? We had a nominee who was, frankly, unwilling to reveal a lot of her comments about even things like settled law, like Roe v. Wade. And we're going to play lots of clips to elucidate some of that. But just how did you see the hearing process itself? And it seems that it's become a kind of, you know, kabuki dance of senators asking questions and the nominee dancing around those questions.
I think that's a good description. I mean, we start from the proposition that the framers anticipated that the confirmation process would be highly politicized. So it's no surprise that it's become that way, and it's been that way off and on over history. I think this in particular was an instance where people may not have tuned in because we expected the Republicans to issue her softballs and the Democrats to ask her questions she wouldn't answer. As a legal scholar, I think I learned a lot about how she thinks and how she would handle certain issues. So I don't think it was a worthless proposition, but it was, for the most part, political theater.
And Michael Moreland, she talked, and others did, about the Ginsburg rule, where then, I guess, Judge Ginsburg talked about just the things that she would not answer. But I have read some to say about Coney Barrett that she took it to a whole, Coney Barrett, that she took it to a whole other level. How did you see that?
I think that these nominees are right not to sort of, as she said, grade precedent, say, yeah, I think that precedent is really strong. And this one I disagree with. And she did answer a lot of questions about her own writings. I mean, she is a very widely published legal scholar and now has decided several cases as a judge on the Seventh Circuit. And so a lot of the questions were probing her views about that. And there she rightly said, yes, I will, of course, talk about that because I've committed myself to writing. And that's where I thought the most interesting conversations in the hearing came about, when especially Democratic senators were interrogating her about originalism, methods of constitutional interpretation, and how they would apply in different contexts.
Well, that's a perfect setup for our second clip here. And I'll get a response from you, Laura Little. This is Senator Mike Lee, Republican, asking Judge Barrett about her judicial philosophy.
Tell me why textualism and originalism are important to you.
Because I think that both statutes and the Constitution are law. They derive their democratic legitimacy from the fact that they have been enacted, in the case of statutes, by the people's representatives, or in the case of the Constitution, through the Constitution-making process. And I, as a judge, have an obligation to respect and enforce only that law that the people themselves have embraced. As I was saying earlier, it's not the law of Amy, it's the law of the American people. And I think originalism and textualism, to me, boil down to that, to a commitment to the rule of law, to not disturbing or changing or updating or, you know, adjusting in line with my own policy preferences what that law requires.
Laura Little, let me go back to you. How do you see textualism and originalism?
Well, I'll start with the proposition that both terms are ambiguous. They're used in different ways. As I can figure out from the way she answered her questions, she sees textualism as something to deal with statutes and originalism as something that points to the Constitution. And the whole idea here is that judges, as best they can, are to be impartial, to be neutral. But of course, judges are human beings. Sure. Law is made by human beings. And therefore, we need some sort of protection against people using their own personal preferences to interpret the law. Originalism is a focus on the meaning of the Constitution as a way of focusing on the actual words, focusing on the framers' intent to keep judges from inject their personal preferences. Critics would say it's just a cover for coming up with a neutral reason for judges to actually find a way to inject their personal preferences. But she calls herself an originalist. She calls herself something that's like Justice Scalia, and his orientation on originalism has been subject to a lot of criticism as a cover for him coming up with his own reasons for injecting his personal preferences. But both of them focus on both textualism and originalism focus on the actual words of the particular law.
Michael Moreland, it's interesting. I mean, there was a lot of talk about Justice Scalia, and she certainly has been a mentee of the late justice. But I'm curious about how you see originalism and textualism, because she seemed to be saying you could be an originalist or a textualist and end up very differently when it comes to a ruling on the court.
Right. I think the benefit of originalism and textualism is that it focuses the debate and focuses the judicial process on the text of a statute or the Constitution and the history behind it. Now, of course, people can come to different conclusions about the history. So a few years ago, when the court decided the case about whether the Second Amendment protected a right to bear arms, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion for the majority that said that it did protect the individual right to bear arms and dug out a lot of historical understanding of the Second Amendment to show that. Justice Stevens, not really an originalist, but his dissent in that case did point to also historical materials to show that it didn't protect the individual right to bear arms. So it doesn't necessarily resolve every question, but I think these methods of interpretation are helpful in focusing the debate. And then, of course, you have other things like the precedence of the court and other kinds of issues that come into play in deciding cases. But yes, very much she is probably the most forthright defender of originalism ever to be nominated to the court.
Wow. Well, let me go back to you, Laura Little, and this is assuming that she, quote-unquote, gets the job, and it certainly looks that way. How do you see her presence on the highest court? How do you see it changing the court, if at all?
I actually don't think it's going to change the court that much. It solidifies a particular conservative majority. And, you know, I'm sure she'll, as she gets more and more comfortable with the job, assuming she does get the job,
yeah,
that she'll become more and more her own person and not necessarily have the Trump point of view or the conservative or the Scalia point of view. But I actually don't see her changing the court that much. I take her at her word that she's not going to take every opportunity she gets to overrule precedent she doesn't like.
Well, let me go back to you, Michael Moreland. And how much do you think what the president has said about the kind of justices he wants, what he wants them to do if they get if they sit on the court, how much do you think that tainted the process?
I think that that the folks that he's nominated, and I would say the same for nominees from various presidents, you know, these are people of strong character who don't end up doing the bidding of just their presidents. Look, I mean, Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh agreed with the majority this last summer in the case involving whether the president could be subpoenaed. And even going back to the Nixon tapes case, all the Nixon appointees, except Justice Rehnquist, who had worked at the Department of Justice, all sided against the president in that case as well, going back to the 1970s. So once people are on the court, I think if they've gone independence of mind to stand up to what the president necessarily wants.
And would you include Chief Justice Roberts in that, Michael?
Oh, very much so. Yes.
And how about for you, Laura? Well, we're almost having a break here, but you know, once they get the job, are they freer to make the decision that they think is in the best interest of the country?
Well, I think that people get comfortable with their independence, but they're taking the job having gotten this wonderful prize from a president that, yeah, gave them the prize of picking them from the sea of hopefuls. And it's hard for me to believe that a woman of her character won't show some loyalty and gratitude to President Trump, at least in the initial years.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the hearings this week by the Senate Judiciary Committee, the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's Temple University's Laura Little. Also with us is Michael Moreland from Villanova University. We're going to take a very short break and we're going to play some more clips. We've got a lot of comments as well. In fact, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, looking back on 4 days of the Senate Judiciary Committee deciding on whether Amy Coney Barrett should sit on the U.S. Supreme Court, talking about a little bit about her philosophy, what we have been learning about her, what we didn't learn, the kind of justice she might make, also how her confirmation could impact the court and the rule of law. And again, our guests are Michael Moreland from Villanova University. He's a law professor there, and Laura Little, a law professor at Temple University. Let me play another clip, and this is Senator Amy Klobuchar, and she's asking Judge Barrett about what the law says about voter intimidation.
Judge Barrett, under federal law, is it illegal to intimidate voters at the polls?
Senator Klobuchar, I can't characterize the facts in a hypothetical situation, and I can't apply the law to a hypothetical set of facts. I can only decide cases as they come to me, litigated by parties on a full record after fully engaging precedent, talking to colleagues, writing an opinion. And so I can't answer questions like
okay,
that.
Okay, well, I'll make it easier. 18 U.S.C. 594 outlaws anyone who intimidates, threatens, coerces, or attempts to intimidate, threaten, or coerce any other person for the purpose of interfering with the right of such other person to vote. This is a law that has been on the books for decades. Do you think a reasonable person would feel intimidated by the presence of armed civilian groups at the polls?
Senator Klobuchar, you know, that is eliciting, I'm not sure whether to say it's eliciting a legal opinion from me because the reasonable person standard, as you know, is one common in the law, or just an opinion as a citizen, but it's not something really that's appropriate for me to comment on.
Let me play one more clip, and this is Senator Dianne Feinstein asking Judge Barrett about the president's powers over the election.
Does the Constitution give the President of the United States the authority to unilaterally delay a general election under any circumstances? Does federal law?
Well, Senator, if that question ever came before me, I would need to hear arguments from the litigants and read briefs and consult with my law clerks and talk to my colleagues and go through the opinion writing process. So, you know, if I give off-the-cuff answers, then I would be basically a legal pundit. And I don't think we want judges to be legal pundits. I think we want judges to approach cases thoughtfully and with an open mind.
Let me get Pamela from Havertown to join our conversation. And Pamela, go ahead.
Yes, actually, I would like to ask this pretty simple question. What do you make of Judge Barrett's refusal or inability to answer pretty simple questions of the law, which even I know the answer to? Does the president have the power to delay an election? And is voter intimidation a crime?
And those were the clips that we heard. Let me toss that first to you, Laura Little.
I think Pamela has a wonderful point here. There's a basic bottom line of, like, what is the law? Kind of, is it raining outside today? Yes or no? You can answer that without suggesting a particular point of view or disposition or bias towards a legal issue that's going to come before the court. She relied on the, I'm a sitting judge, I might be a sitting justice, excuse in a very broad way. And I agree with Pamela's point.
How about for you, Michael Moreland?
I think that, you know, like Laura says, sure there were, you know, kind of questions that she and I, better say Laura and I, might ask, you know, our law students on a quiz, you know, what's the answer? You know, what did this case say or what did that case say? And those were certainly appropriate questions. And you know, Judge Barrett, I think, thought that those, though, were opening up into, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? What do you think about this eventuality? And that's the road that she and the, you know, people advising her in terms of how to answer these questions decided that they didn't even want to open the door to those.
But these are questions that involve the president, whether it's a peaceful transfer of power, whether he can delay an election, about, you know, poll watchers and the possibility of voter intimidation. Michael, let me just go back to you. You know, I'm sure the president, if he wasn't watching every moment of the hearings, you know, knows what's going on there. One has to speculate whether she was somehow sending a message to the president, to the Oval Office.
Well, again, I think that she has the, to say at least, has the strength of character, as have prior nominees, that if she's confirmed, I don't think she's just going to be the, you know, do the president's bidding on these kinds of issues. But I think she also didn't want to telegraph, not so much maybe to him, but I think, to compromise her integrity or to compromise her impartiality as a judge, should it come up involving the election, let's hope not, or involving the scope of presidential power in this or some other context.
Laura, there was a question about whether she should or would recuse herself if the court has to weigh in on the November election, especially the results of who becomes the next president of the United States. Should she recuse herself?
There's a very good argument in favor of her recusing herself. There was an interesting interchange, I think it was with Senator Leahy, about another Scalia clerk, her name's Joan Larson, she's a judge on the Sixth Circuit, that had been on Trump's short list when he was first running for president. And it turned out that as she was sitting as a federal judge on the Sixth Circuit, an election question came up, and she chose to recuse herself in that instance. And the question was, well, would you, Judge Barrett, do the same yourself? And she said, well, that's something different because that was an actual case, and I'm not going to answer a hypothetical question. But I think it's different to be able to answer before the fact whether or not your conscience, which is going to carry you through the confirmation process, whether your conscience would be bothered by sitting on a case where, in fact, it's so clear that the president has made very, very certain that you might be someone that would vote in his favor if there's a contested election. So I think the argument is very strong. She should recuse herself. There's precedent, people actually coming out and saying in their questionnaires before the Senate, when they're nominees, that they would recuse themselves on particular issues. And I don't really see why she shouldn't make that clear now.
Michael, let me read an email from Warren. He says, were there any questions that identified her using her judicial judgment against her conservative credentials, thereby showing she is as fair as she claims? Can you take that?
Sure. There, in your record as a judge, there as a judge on the Seventh Circuit the last 3 years, there have been some cases involving criminal law, criminal defendants and the rights of criminal defendants. Also, the issue of qualified immunity for the police when the police engage in tactics that are unconstitutional, and in both of those instances, it was elicited that she, as someone who applies the law as she says as it's written, that she came to conclusions that arguably, she didn't put it quite like this, but arguably are at odds with her otherwise kind of conservative sensibilities, and that's in keeping with other justices on the more conservative side of the court, like Justice Gorsuch and the late Justice Scalia, who have often in opinions been quite sympathetic to criminal defendants in certain contexts.
Let me play another clip. And this is Judge Barrett's response to a question that Dianne Feinstein put having to do with this issue of severability in relation to the Affordable Care Act. Now, this is kind of weedy legal stuff, but it's about whether if you remove a part of the health care law, can you do that without destroying the rest of the statute? Let's hear her response.
Severability strives to look at a statute as a whole and say, would Congress have considered this provision so vital that kind of in the Jenga game, pulling it out, Congress wouldn't want the statute anymore? So it's designed to effectuate your intent. But, severability is designed to say, well, would Congress still want the statute to stand even with this provision gone? Would Congress have still passed the same statute without it? So I think insofar as it tries to effectuate what Congress would have wanted, it's the court and Congress working hand in hand.
Well, let me go to you, Laura Little. I mean, it's interesting to hear her talk that way about the Affordable Care Act, knowing that in a couple of weeks it's going to be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. What was the message, both, I guess, in the question and also the answer?
I guess I first point out that she gave that was an accurate description of the severability concept. And that's the type of question, is it raining outside? She was able to give a straightforward answer and was very, very comfortable with that. In terms of what it means for the future, she gave no indication of how she would rule. The question of severability is very much a judgment call. It's hard to know the intent of a collective body like Congress in terms of whether this collective body foresee that, in fact, part of the law may be struck down as unconstitutional. So it's very much a guessing game, and I don't think she gave any indication of what she would do.
Michael, Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham asked her a lot about the severability and the Affordable Care Act. And I was just, this is more a political question, wondering whether there was a message being sent, because it turns out the Affordable Care Act is rather popular with the American public. And it is one of the key issues that is driving this presidential election, whether there was some kind of political message being sent out from the Judiciary Committee about the Affordable Care Act and whether it would survive, you know, severability.
I think that's right. And it was clear from the start of the hearing with the opening statements from Democratic senators that they were going to focus on the Affordable Care Act. And it was a strategic political choice on their part not to, as some had feared, not to go after Amy Barrett for her religion or, you know, character or anything like that, but really to highlight this this issue of the Affordable Care Act. And then on the Republican side, I think trying to allay concerns that even with this now zeroed out penalty, which is the issue that's in the case that will be heard in a few weeks, that the rest of the statute, including the very popular parts of the statute involving pre-existing conditions, coverage for kids till they're 26 and so forth, that there's a pretty broad consensus on the Supreme Court right now. And again, this gets kind of weedy and technical, but some cases last term that indicated this very strongly. Pretty broad consensus that you can excise an unconstitutional part of a statute and then the rest of the statute still survives. And so I think they're trying to telegraph that, say, the Republicans, you know, don't worry about what the Democrats are saying.
Laura, let me ask you a little bit about just her family. I mean, it's, you know, seven children, several adopted children from Haiti. There was a lot of talk about her family and a lot of praise for her family. Sounds like completely well-deserved. How did you see that?
That's a wonderful question, because I think it shows that as a woman, all of a sudden her family and her children become much more important. You don't see those type of questions when it's a male nominee. That's not to say it was wrong. I can say very much that she put her family at issue. She talked about how she was worried about her faith being caricatured. She talked about how people would make fun of her family or comment a lot about her family. I mean, certainly, I think it goes to the idea that she was a dream nominee for those of a particular point of view, because how can anyone that's decent not embrace what she's done in terms of adopting children from Haiti and the like?
And that's Laura Little, who joins us along with Michael Moreland. We're talking about Judge Amy Coney Barrett, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me put a question to you, Michael. This is we got a lot of questions, which is great. One from Lori: how does Judge Barrett's involvement with people of praise factor into how she would perform her role as a justice? And there's always that question about if you're a person of faith, you know, how do you view the law, how do you view how you live your religion and how you live leave the law itself.
Right. Well, I actually wrote a piece, which someone can Google if they're interested, and look up at National Review Online on this issue of people of praise and Amy Barrett's affiliation with it. Look, as she said in her first confirmation hearing to the Seventh Circuit, that she would not, as a judge, seek to impose her personal beliefs, that's not the role of a judge. The role of a judge is to apply the law as written and as interpreted. At one point, there's some very unfortunate kind of chatter about people of praise, which is this 1970s era kind of charismatic Christian group that runs some schools and to which Judge Barrett and her family are affiliated. But I think in the end, it turned out, and rightly on the part of Senate Democrats, not to be an issue that they wanted to raise, because, you know, it really does, I think, start to raise some very serious concerns about a religious test for someone.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Carl. He says, originalism is nonsense. Other countries revise their constitutions regularly, updating it for modern times and modern concerns. Originalists are the equivalent of religious zealots, and the Constitution is their Bible. What do you think about that, Laura Little?
Originalism is an attempt to try to constrain a lot of latitude in judges' interpretations. I agree with the proposition that it's sort of It's not a realistic way of approaching the law because there's so many ways of wiggling out of what the originalist intent is. So, for example, the Constitution says that the president has to be a natural-born citizen. To take it to an absurd end, does that mean that somebody born by cesarean section cannot be the president?
Lordy. Really?
I mean, it just to give you an idea that if you focus just on the words and try to divine the intent of a group of people that lived several hundred years ago, it's a fool's errand. But it's nonetheless legitimate to the extent that we're trying to find a way to tether our interpretation to one fixed point of view. And if we want to change the Constitution, it's really hard, yep, but we can do that. And that fixed point of view can be changed if we really need to.
Michael, you want to weigh in on this?
I think that originalists say, and I'm, you know, probably a little more sympathetic to it than Lori is, originalists say that, look, this is what the rule of law means. It means that when laws are written, that they have a fixed meaning and that the job of judges is to interpret that meaning and to apply it, but not to change it. And that's the job for the legislature, or in the case of a constitution, this goes back to the email question. Sure, the constitution can be amended. So the 14th Amendment, for example, is a very important change in the meaning of a lot of our constitutional rights. But that's because it was enacted through an amendment process, not because judges made up new law.
We're almost having a break here, but do you agree that it is hard to amend the U.S. Constitution, Michael?
It is, and by design, which means that there's been a lot of room for the political branches, both the federal and the state level, to engage in different kinds of policymaking. It's a kind of deep question, I guess, of our own constitutional law. Is it a feature or a bug that it's hard to amend? And I'd be a little more on the side of saying that that's a strong feature of our Constitution.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Michael Moreland and Laura Little. Michael is a professor of law at Villanova University, just outside of Philadelphia. Laura Little is a professor of law at Temple University here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about what we learned this week about Judge Amy Coney Barrett and what her presence on the U.S. Supreme Court could mean. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break, plus some more clips as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what we learned this week about Judge Amy Coney Barrett, what we didn't learn, and assuming she gets the job of U.S. Supreme Court Justice, how her presence could change the highest court and the rule of law. Our guests are Laura Little. She's a professor of law at Temple University, author of a recent book on humor and the law called Guilty Pleasures, and she's working on a book about the First Amendment. Michael Moreland with us as well, professor of law, director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy at Villanova University. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can do it the old-fashioned way and call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me play another clip from the testimony this week. And this is Senator Amy Klobuchar. And she's questioning Judge Barrett about a law review article Barrett wrote on super precedents and asked her if she considers Roe to be among them.
Is Roe a super precedent?
How would you define super precedent?
I thought someday I'd be sitting in that chair. I'm not. I'm up here, so I'm asking
okay,
you.
Okay, well, people use super precedent differently.
Okay.
The way that it's used in the scholarship and the way that I was using it in the article that you're reading from was to define cases that are so well settled that no political actors and no people seriously push for their overruling. And I'm answering a lot of questions about Roe, which I think indicates that Roe doesn't fall in that category. And scholars across the spectrum say that doesn't mean that Roe should be overruled, But descriptively, it does mean that it's not a case that everyone has accepted and doesn't call for its overruling.
So, Laura Little, what is she saying there?
Well, first, let me say that the definition of super president is, in fact, quite slippery. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's a term of art. It's not something that's accepted as part of legal doctrine. So that it's it's a term that you can use to your own devices or your own purposes. What she's saying, I think, is that she defines super president in a way that doesn't include Roe. One could redefine or one could interpret that term to include Roe. And I think the way that you would do that is by saying Roe deals with a highly contestable, inflammatory issue. It has been part of the law since the early 1970s, and it's something that, in fact, would be quite unsettling to our society to overrule. And for that reason, because part of constitutional interpretation focuses on trying not to unsettle society, it's one of those precedents that should be kept in place.
Michael, let me turn to you. And everyone seems to agree that Brown versus the Board of Education meets this definition of super precedent. No one is trying to overturn Brown. But how do you see super precedent as it is applied to Roe? And I mean, I think it should be said that Amy Coney Barrett opposes abortion. I mean, let's just be honest here.
Right. Yeah, it is. As Laura says, it's a term that I think the first use of it was our own Arlen Specter here in Pennsylvania back in the hearings for John Roberts and Sam Alito when he was chair of the Judiciary Committee. And he talked about this idea of, you know, some precedents being so important that they couldn't be revisited. And then there's been a little scholarship and commentary on that idea. And so Judge Barrett was, you know, referring to that scholarship or that idea that there's some precedents that no one's trying to overrule, and they're kind of fixed in the canon. Marbury versus Madison involving the power of judicial review in the first place, and Brown versus Board of Education being another. But the point that she's making there, of course, in response to Senator Klobuchar, is that Roe versus Wade continues to be very contested. It has not become, well settled in the minds of a lot of the American people. There continue to be a lot of cases involving abortion regulation. In fact, I think the last time I was on this show, we talked about the Louisiana case that the court heard this past year. And so on the one hand, yes, she has expressed her own pro-life views as a policy matter. As a judge, of course, the question that would come before her in the court would be, you know, is this restriction consistent with Roe and Casey, or does it invite revisiting Roe and Planned Parenthood versus Casey in another way? And as to that, of course, she was reluctant and unwilling to engage on that issue. But that's going to become the question if the court starts to hear some abortion cases.
Do you think Roe will be overturned, Laura Little?
It's hard to say. Because it is so contested and because it's so entrenched in our jurisprudence, my best guess is that it will be dismantled piece by piece and that there will not be a thunderbolt that's issued that says Roe versus Wade is hereby overruled. But it's very hard to get into the justice's mind and also to predict what cases are going to come before the court that will provide an opportunity to overrule Roe. And that all goes into the mix of trying to figure out the future of Roe.
Let me read some more comments here. One from John. What concerns me most about Judge Barrett is that she said she believes in science, but when Senator Harris asked her about climate change, she said it was, quote, controversial. Climate change isn't controversial. It's science. This should make her ineligible. An email from Richard says, I'm bored by the legal discussion of Amy Barrett. It's more important to discuss the GOP and how it has completed the politicization of every branch of government, including the Supreme Court. A comment from Rick. Regardless of politics, Judge Barrett is an extremely intelligent and qualified woman and would make us proud. Let me play one more clip. It's about a minute. And this is Cory Booker, Senator Booker, asking Judge Barrett about the Trump administration's policy about separating children from their parents at the border.
Do you think it's wrong to separate children from their parents to deter immigrants from coming to the United States?
Well, Senator Booker, that's been a matter of policy debate, and, you know, obviously that's a matter of hot political debate in which I can't express a view or be drawn into as a judge.
So I respect that a lot, but I think the underlying question is actually not hotly debated, and just maybe I'll ask it one more time. Do you think it's wrong to separate a child from their parent, not for the safety of the child or parent, but to send a message? As a human being, do you believe that that's wrong?
Well, Senator, I think you're trying to engage me on the administration's border separation policies, and I can't express a view on that. So I'm not expressing assent or dissent with the morality of that position. I just can't be drawn into a debate about the administration's immigration policy.
Michael Moreland, let me put this to you. Why can't she say that it is wrong to separate children from their parents at the border?
Well, I think, as she said, once she said that, then it would have opened the door to engaging in a lot of other kind of political debates. And you know, I'm sure her personal views are ones that are, you know, pretty appalled by this. But on the other hand, she's not a politician or up for a political role in this hearing. And so I think that, again, as we talked about earlier, I think that she and the people who she's been working with in preparation for this, I think they took the view that just don't get drawn into these kinds of debates, and that was a better course than deciding, you know, what things are, you know, like on the climate change issue, right? Sure, she could have maybe weighed in on climate change and the science behind it, but that's not really relevant to the job for which she's being vetted.
Laura Little, do you think the public was kind of lost out that she wasn't able to answer some of these questions?
I do. As I said, we have to expect that it's going to be a political process and that there's going to be a lot of, you know, spreading of the tail feathers on both sides. And she has to watch what she thinks may be setting a trap in terms of trying to get her real views on things. Part of that is ethical, and part of that, or I'd say most of it, is strategic on her part to try to get the job. And we lost out in terms of really knowing what type of human being she is.
Mm. Here's a tweet from Alan. My objection to this nominee is the process rather than the candidate. It has bluntly injected politics into the court when her expedited hearing is compared to what happened with Merrick Garland. It made SCOTUS a GOP court, not unbiased justice. And let me just quote from Senator Graham. This is something he said in 2016. And I'm quoting here. I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination. And you could use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right. Let me turn to you, Michael Moreland. He took back those words by sitting on this Judiciary Committee. And, you know, I wonder whether that hurts the whole process. And whether it hurts, frankly, the court.
Well, look, there's hypocrisy and self-serving norm violation on every side. and
this is pretty egregious, though, wouldn't you say? I mean,
well,
he said it.
I think, and I do think that in the Garland nomination fight, which it turned out not to be much of a fight because they didn't even give him a hearing, I think that the Senate Republicans, you know, would have been better served had they said, look, we're just because we have the majority, we're not going to confirm President Obama's nominee. Mm-hmm. And now we've gotten into this whole thing of trying to slice the onion thinly, saying, well, if it's the Senate, it's the same, you know, party as the president and it's election year and so forth. And so there, I think, look, they won the presidential election. They control the Senate. They're going to exercise their power in a constitutionally legitimate way. I mean, I think these charges of quote unquote illegitimacy are inapt because it's permissible under the Constitution. But sure, is there a kind of self-dealing and hypocrisy? Absolutely, but that's politics.
Well, let me ask
Marty,
go ahead.
If I could just add one thing.
Yes, indeed.
It's my understanding that Judge Barrett herself, at the time of Justice Scalia's death said, at a time very, very close to an election, where you have a judge who is purportedly going to be replaced by another judge of a very different ideological point of view, you should wait. You should wait after the election is over so that, in fact, you don't have that kind of unsettling changing one judge for another. And you can just sort of put Ruth Bader Ginsburg up against Amy Coney Barrett and see that kind of contrast, I think, that she was talking about.
Well, and you're quoting or summarizing what Amy Coney Barrett said about what happens.
Said in 2016.
So what does that make of her sitting there for several days in that chair?
It suggests that, in fact, she's now taking a different point of view, that the shoe's on the other foot.
Quickly, Michael.
I will say that the defenders of Judge Barrett have pointed out that in that TV interview, she was characterizing, you know, descriptively characterizing the views that others had, that she wasn't expressing her own view about that. But, you know, again, as I said, there's a lot of politics in this whole process. And that's, as Laura said early on, that's how the framers intended it, that this is a political process to appoint people who in the end aren't purely political actors, but they do have to go through a political process in order to get on the bench.
And that's Michael Moreland, who joins us along with Laura Little. And I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me get Chris from Ambler to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
What'd you say?
Yeah, you're on the air. Chris, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Judge Barrett has proudly claimed it, made it clear that her job is not to make political decisions. But I wish the Democratic representatives, one of them, had pointed out to her that just by sitting in that chair and choosing to accept the nomination from a president who has shown his nature and announced how he plans to use her position on the bench to achieve specific ends, Judge Barrett has made one of the most impactful political decisions ever made in the 21st century.
Well, I appreciate, Chris, your comment. Let me get a response. Let me toss that first to you, Laura Little. Do you see it that way?
I actually don't see her changing the course of the court that dramatically. So I'm not quite clear on what's the most impactful political decision that Chris was referring to.
I think what Chris is saying, and hopefully, Chris, I'm summarizing you here, and I'm also looking at the clock so we don't run out of time. But that you've got a president who, you know, has disrespected members of the court. If you cross him or criticize him, he'll be very critical back. We know what he said about other judges and justices. And I think what Chris is saying is by sitting there, are you sort of enabling this kind of presidential talk, Laura?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, these are unusual circumstances in how much both President Trump and some of the more vociferous Republican senators have spoken as to what she represents and what they want out of her seat. So I don't know if you can necessarily fault her, except that by accepting this position, she is enabling it. But it is unusual in that, in fact, it suggests that she'll carry their water for at least a while and accomplish the ends that they've trumpeted.
Michael, we're almost out of time here. 15 seconds. I'll give you the last word.
Well, again, I think the Nixon precedent shows that you can appoint justices to the court, and those justices, if they're people of character, and I think Amy Barrett is unquestionably a person of great character, they'll be able to make independent decisions regardless of political pressure.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times, Villanova University's Michael Moreland. Michael, thanks for joining us once again.
Always glad to be with you.
You're very welcome. And Laura Little, professor of law at Temple University. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.